Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Today my guest is Darcy Weir. First, a couple of announcements. Our website is forbiddenknowledge.news. This is also the Forbidden Knowledge Network. That's where you find some of your favorite podcasts featured, like Raised by Giants, Understanding Propaganda, Day Zero, What the Frick Live, and more. Forbidden Knowledge News is always on Rockfin, Odyssey, Rumble, and all podcast platforms. Our social media is Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Be sure to check us out on Rockfin. This is where you get our premium content. You also get all the premium content from every creator on Rockfin. Just go to rockfin.com/FKN+. That's rokfin.com/FKN+, or click the link in the description. All of our links are right there in the description. Today I want to welcome back to the show Darcy Weir. He is an independent documentary filmmaker, trained as a video editor, writer, director, and producer. He has chosen to work on some of the most fascinating subjects that are discussed today, including ufology, paranormal, and our hidden reality. Darcy, welcome back. How you doing?
Good. How you doing, Chris? Good to be here.
Yeah, man, I'm excellent. Been looking forward to this. We're going to be talking about the latest in your series of films, Secret Space UFOs. This one focuses on NASA's first missions. This film does a great job of not only reminding us about the evidence that has been available to the public for a long time, but presenting some information that I was telling you before, I wasn't even aware of, including amazing footage and images that really make this phenomenon difficult to dismiss as swamp gas, to say the least. Now, let's start with what brought you to make this series of films in particular about secret space UFOs?
Well, I was already working on sort of outer space related UFO encounters. In the past, I had done a doc back in 2017 called Beyond the Spectrum, and it was really just mostly about astronaut encounters. And I was working with a friend, Kerry Martinuk, as of the past 3 years. And the plan really was, what if we go back to the inception of NASA? And we pull the best evidence that NASA has had a sort of a process in place since the starting to classify material, and then operating under that presumption that they have a process for classifying material, what would fall under that? And that's when we started to figure out, okay, you know, there's the Executive Order 10501, which Eisenhower put into motion in 1952, going to 1953. And that allowed safeguarding of information from the public to observe or learn about certain things, whether that was a research institution like a university or national defense information. All this stuff then had a framework after that executive order to prevent certain information from making it to the public. And things could be classified as a threat to national security, whether that's, threats of information that could be leaked to an adversary, or a threat to the public economically or socioeconomically. So our social psyche as a group, the public being able to understand that information and not causing panic that would then, unravel the national security, which is, the United States is a corporation, and the security of the economic machine behind that corporation is at, the utmost importance for some of these defense initiatives and intelligence and security initiatives. And I think back in the 1950s, UFOs were being observed as one of these things that could threaten the public's socioeconomic well-being. And so, once we identified that was a possible reason for NASA to classify information. We then looked at what the earliest UFO reports were that came out of our astronauts, out of missions that were being conducted either at the edge of space. So that would be the rocket-powered X-15 missions that would go to the edge of our atmosphere and outer space. And then our first missions in orbit, which would be Mercury and Gemini. And, you know, there was many missions under those two different capsules, the Redstone capsule. And these missions were the precursor to sending man to the moon. So the idea is, okay, we go to the edge of space, then we go into space, then we go from there to the moon through cislunar space and go where no man has gone before. And they called the earlier missions the bridge to the moon. That's what Gemini was labeled. And all of the capabilities that they had to practice and master in orbit around the Earth, but still in space, would then be carried on through to orbiting the moon and eventually landing on the moon.
Right on. Now, I found it very interesting, the series of events that led up to the moon landing and our modern space program, and the way that UFO sightings started being seen more abundantly after World War II in the 1950s, and that's when conveniently Eisenhower established this executive order to really protect classified materials from NASA, and it also coincided with when the UFO phenomenon became classified as top secret, right?
Yep. Yep. So it all kind of makes sense, you know. It was all happening at the same time. And this has been a rumor since the beginning, like, hey, what if they classified this information through some kind of legal method? And that is the legal method. And if people, you hear people say that it's unconstitutional not to allow the public to know about UFOs, UAPs, and that, you know, it's that the military apparatus or the research institutions of the government are breaking the law by not allowing us to know about it. Well, they aren't breaking the law if it's written into the law that far back in history, that they're allowed to safeguard that information from the public, right?
Well, let's talk about some of these X-15 flights. These were amazing. Without giving away too much of your documentary, talk about some of the most profound aspects of this. We have, you know, of course, Pilot Major Robert White seeing multiple objects. Many other multiple sightings were actually seen from these X-15 test flights, right?
Yeah. So Robert White was the first well-documented astronaut. These were the first classifications that a pilot could be considered an astronaut because they flew at apogee. They were pretty much out of the atmosphere in space. They had gone that far. And Robert White, he had reported back to ground control that there were things up there flying alongside of him. And, you know, if you look at the interview that came out of Life magazine, because Life magazine became interested in this event and they thoroughly interviewed him. And he said, well, I didn't know what it was at first. It looked like something may have come off the craft, like some kind of, he thought it could have been condensation from the tank or something that had frozen, broken off, because, you know, it's pretty cold up there. But when he realized that it was keeping pace and staying alongside of the craft, that's when he realized, okay, this is anomalous. This is not, you know, at that point he was up around 271,000 feet and flying at the you know, fastest speeds any aircraft had, or in this case, a suborbital spacecraft had flown. Mm-hmm. And nothing should be up there keeping pace and following. So that was the first sort of odd thing. And then Joseph Walker, another American test pilot in the early NASA space program, he indicated that after, once he was retired and he was thoroughly interviewed by folks at a conference, he said he actually unveiled multiple pictures of UFOs that he had taken on his mission in the X-15 age. And he said that it was actually a task that was given to the pilots of the X-15 missions to take more pictures of UFOs if they, you know, saw them or recognized anything like that on their missions. So the fact that one pilot testified to the public that he had had that initial experience, and then Joseph Walker later on says this was actually part of our mission to take photos and whatever documentation we could. I mean, from the X-15 mission on, the pilots were trained very heavily on how to use still photography cameras. Usually they were Hasselblads, which were specially designed by Victor Hasselblad, which was at the time, it was like the Canon. You know how everybody wants to have a Canon DSLR these days when they're doing photography or videography? It was like the Canon standard of the 1960s. You had to have a Hasselblad if you were to be considered a really talented photographer. And these pilots were trained on how to use Hasselblads, how to use DAC motion picture film cameras, which shot at multiple different film speeds. And that indicates right there that NASA was curious what was up there. And obviously there's going to be all kinds of things that are going to be up there that can be accounted for as, you know, natural, atmospheric, sometimes space ice.
Now, but this was all within our atmosphere. This was, the X-15 flights hadn't gone beyond that.
They were really close to being in space. They mm-hmm. were right at the perimeter of space and the atmosphere. So they were seeing things in space clearer than, you know, outside of the, let's say the optical pollution or the light pollution that we would be used to being on Earth, right? So that's why it was important for NASA to capture as much as they could on camera. And in the documentary, we further explore that in the Mercury missions as well as the Gemini missions. And then we delve into the VTR transcripts, which were kind of like the black box flight recorders that were installed to each of the capsules when they went on those missions.
Yeah, let's get into some of those Mercury missions and some of the profound information that came out of those. You have some accounts from John Glenn and Scott Carpenter who reported like strange firefly-like lights, right?
Yeah. So the interesting thing about Alan Shepard, he was the first guy to be actually in orbit around Earth in space. And Alan Shepard quickly noticed that there was something floating around the capsule and then sometimes flying off to the left, going away from the capsule. And he thought that they were attracted to the capsule, which was a good observation because whenever you have something that's of a certain weight and mass in space, it creates its own gravity. In this case with Alan Shepard, the fireflies that he was observing were most likely just space ice. And it was described by William Walter Schirra, who was a mission leader for the Gemini missions, but also flew on the Mercury missions as an astronaut. he described what that ice to be is like nitrogen, or no, instead of, yeah, so NH2O, right, means that you have nitrogen and you have oxygen, and they're binded, which makes water, right? And in this case, there's no O, so it was just like frozen nitrogen particles. And they had come off of the capsule because for some reason, nitrogen had been freezing to the capsule as it left the atmosphere. And then it was flaking off and revolving around the capsule. And the sun was glinting the ice particles as they went by, so they look like fireflies or something that was, you know, emitting energy or whatever, but it was actually just a trick of light. But I found that to be an interesting experience for the public, because if you got to remember, we're at a point in time where people weren't, you know, they didn't have big OLED or 4K flat screens sitting around their homes and their offices. They had usually radios, and they would be glued to the radio. The whole family would sit around the radio after dinner in the living room, and they would listen to what the news was or what was going on in their area. And these space missions, some of them were radio transmitted to the public, at least definitely the Apollo missions had a public radio channel, and then they had a national defense channel that their vitals and their sort of health was being reported, and they could report to Capcom on that, which was kind of like a secret encrypted channel. But with the public channel, Alan Shepard is reporting, oh my God, there's these things, they're flying around the capsule and they look like fireflies and they're beautifully emitting this light and they're going around the capsule and then drifting off, and there's thousands of them, you know, there's thousands and thousands of them. And so people are listening to their radio and they're like thinking, oh my God, is there an invasion happening? Like, are aliens here? And so that was a pretty exciting transmission of our early space endeavors to the public. And it caused a bit of hysteria in the public at the time. And I think NASA wanted to nip that in the bud. They did not want that to happen again. So what happened with Alan Shepard was okay, but when Scott Carpenter flew his mission also during the Mercury trials, he was supposed to re-enter into the atmosphere, and he was being distracted, and he was reporting back to ground control, look, there's something anomalous up here, I'm not quite sure what it is, it shouldn't be here. And you can listen to those recordings. But because he got so distracted, he wasn't following his mission checklist. Like, NASA and the military, a lot of the way that personnel run everything is with checklists, right? It's to keep track of everything that should be done in a sequence in order to achieve the outcome that is your goal. And so NASA's goal is send people up, make them follow the checklist so that they can come back down safely. And Scott Carpenter got so distracted by a UFO, I think, because at this point he had heard about the fireflies, right? He should have ignored Alan Shepard's fireflies, because if they really were just ice particles that he was seeing, he would have been debriefed about that being a possible phenomenon that could be observed, and he shouldn't have been distracted. So I think whatever he saw was likely a credible UFO encounter. And he didn't follow his mission checklist. He ran low on fuel and he entered the atmosphere late. By entering the atmosphere late, he missed the target area he was supposed to land in the ocean. He landed in a totally far off location. They got to him in time. He survived. All is good. No, not really. NASA fired him. NASA made an example of Scott Carpenter, and they actually attacked him as a non-competent pilot. And he went on the defense and said, look, their cover story is that I ran out of fuel and I wasn't looking at my fuel gauge properly because I was being distracted and I'm not competent. But he pointed out to the public, look, I didn't run out of fuel. That's just their story. And I am a competent pilot. And I still got back to the planet and survived. So whatever. But I think the point was that NASA wanted to make an example of him so that future astronauts, if they had the idea to get distracted by UFOs, to not follow their mission checklist, and to make a big deal about it, again, they may run the risk of being fired and being publicly humiliated, which that's what happened to Scott Carpenter. Yeah. And if you look at all of the missions that happened after Gemini, Mercury, after Scott Carpenter's firing, what happened? The pilots were all very shush-shush about what happened in space. It was, you know, as if there was no anomalies to be seen, nothing to see here. Although some pilots, like James McDivitt, reported one on his Gemini 4 mission. And we had the VTR transcripts where that was being reported. He went on live television. He went on radio interviews after the fact as a young man and testified to the fact that he saw something that should not be there. And based on ground tracking radar data, it shouldn't have been there. It wasn't an upper stage of a rocket. So some astronauts would slip and talk about anomalies or UFO type encounters that they had seen and witnessed when they were up there, but the vast majority would not. And I think that's because they just weren't brave enough to be labeled a UFO quack or jeopardize losing their status and their career.
I want to go back to the Gemini missions. As far as the transcripts and some of the incredible footage that came out of those missions, it's really hard to debunk some of these transcripts and the information that came out of there.
Yeah, I mean, many missions had anomalies. And again, many of the missions they were tasked with taking photos with the Hasselblads and taking footage with the DAC motion picture camera. The public has seen many of the photos. The motion picture footage, no. That's like in a vault somewhere. We'll probably never see it unless it gets declassified. Another one of NASA's sort of tricks is to just say they lost or destroyed footage, which is incredible for an institution that had been funded. If you look at the cost to send astronauts into space during the Gemini, Mercury, and Apollo manned missions, it's like trillions of dollars today in terms of funding. So each one of those photos and each canister of that film is worth billions of dollars. How could they just lose it or destroy it? You know, it should be considered, it should be handled with the utmost care because it was such a highly funded operation and that data is highly valuable, therefore. Anyways, we do have examples of pictures that we go through in many of the Gemini missions where it looks like either the photo has been doctored, it looks like the photo has been covered up, smudged, or inked out Maybe they did. There was an object that was located in the photo that they didn't want the public to see. In other photos, you actually see objects. And, you know, Tracy Starnes is a friend who did a bit of research, provided some photos and stuff that came from the archive, but also these photos that he examined, they came from a university. So sometimes what would happen back in the early space exploration days of NASA, photos would get disseminated to university archives, and they would also go into NASA's archives. And some of the photos would not be the same. The reason why is because they took so many photos on these missions and footage that they would have some copies that they would keep internal and some copies that they would give to academic institutions. Those photos that still go to universities, not all of them are public. I don't know why that would be, but unless they have to classify them or they have to ask for permission from NASA before they're allowed to disseminate that to the public, that would make sense. But Tracy found some photos that had come from, I think it was Duke University, and they show UFOs. They show anomalous objects inside, and I think that was Gemini 11. Now, if you think about it, on the Gemini missions, you have some of the very same astronauts that flew on the Apollo missions. You have Neil Armstrong. You have Buzz Aldrin. Edward Aldrin. You have Edwin. You have guys like Alan Shepard, who would die in the Apollo 1 mission. And not Alan Shepard, sorry, Gus Grissom. You know, all of these guys were these test pilots that were being pushed from one project to the next in terms of space exploration. They kind of were graduating to the next stage and process and being groomed and allowed to move on. And, you know, Frank Borman during Gemini 7, he reported back to ground control a bogey. We have a bogey. And usually when you describe a bogey in, you know, as a pilot, you're trying to report an adversary craft or an unknown in your airspace. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can just look up the basic definition. That's what it is. And when he got back, Life magazine and all these other like journalists said, you know, we heard you had a bogey spotted, what was it? And he immediately, you know, went on the disinformation campaign and said, oh, it was nothing. But NASA, I think, has a way of making sure that all of that information is kept from the public. And they don't want the public talking about that. They don't want to cause panic. And this is exemplary in the making of Close Encounters of the Third Kind by Steven Spielberg. He reached out to NASA, he reached out to the military, and he tried to get funding. Oftentimes, big Hollywood productions like Pearl Harbor, that film, they asked for military funding, they got it, and they got to recreate these amazing, you know, attack and air battle scenes and stuff because they were given the military equipment for free and sometimes some funding. When it came to Close Encounters of the Third Kind, the military replied to Steven Spielberg's request with a short letter saying, we're not going to provide any assistance because we don't believe in this topic. We found our findings conclusively found that UFOs, there's nothing to them in the, what do you call it? The Brookings report. And we're not going to help. So he was like, okay. NASA wrote like a 6-page letter imploring him not to make the film because they did not want the public to be hassling them, and they didn't want UFO sightings to go up. They didn't want this to become a phenomenon where the public was enamored or interested in this subject in any way. And you can find that on, I think, the special edition, the Criterion Collection of Close Encounters of the Third Kind. It's like a special features where he talks about he was denied funding and how NASA implored him not to do it. You know, it's out there in the public. Why would NASA have that stance so early on? And at this point, when Close Encounters was made, it was the 1970s. So what I'm saying is, with their pilots like Frank Borman during Gemini, they knew not to talk about this stuff, and they knew to misinform and disinform the public if they ever asked about it.
Now, I want to go back to some of those shady practices that we hear about often from NASA, from former whistleblowers and former NASA employees that say that, yes, they are actually taking photos and they are scrubbing them and blotting out pictures and altering these photos and losing them, right?
Yep. You know, there's whole swath of individuals who have reported that. So you've got Mike Barra, Richard Hoagland, who was a CBC science correspondent for the Mars and Moon missions back in the 1960s and 70s. You have Carol Rawson, who said she worked for, you know,
was it Von Braun?
Werner Von Braun.
Yeah.
And she said, you know, one of the ultimate cards is going to be this invasion card or whatever, but that it was standard practice also to filter the information that went to the public, especially if it was anomalous or UFO related. And then you have, her name is escaping me, brain fog. COVID, Donna Hare, who actually worked for Jet Propulsion Lab. And she reported through the Disclosure Project in collaboration with Dr. Stephen Greer that when she was working for the space program through a third party contractor, she met with NASA personnel. They were all afraid to report the anomalous UFO or lunar anomalies that were seen on the moon. And one of their standard practices, whenever they got the film back or they got the celluloid still images, they would, you know, start working on that, going through blotting out or making copies, excuse me. Oftentimes, even Ken, I think it's Ken Johnson Jr., he even reported that on Apollo 11, there was supposedly an encounter when they first landed and they did their first EVA, their moonwalk. They reported back to Capcom, you know, these guys, they're here, they're on the edge of the crater, they're huge and, you know, kind of intimidating. He was reporting, I guess, a craft or something. And there was footage. But as soon as that footage got back to Earth, Ken Johnson Jr. said that they would have spliced out that part of the footage, the film, DAC motion picture footage, put it back together, and then made a duplicate on a projector and handed that back to their official archives. So I think, yeah. I mean, I think that's a very strong possibility.
Now, since you mentioned the moon landing, of course, there's a lot of controversy surrounding the question of whether we even went or not, and did Stanley Kubrick actually direct the moon landing and the filming of this? What are your thoughts on this? Do you think that we actually, that we succeeded, but that we can't show the public or tell the public some of the things that really happened because there could have been some kind of UFO or extraterrestrials in the vicinity?
My firm belief, just from looking into this, and I'm a young guy, there's dudes that have been around, ladies and gentlemen, who probably looked into this for years beyond my existence, but my opinion is that what we're really dealing with when we go outside of our planet and we witness UFOs in space or relic technology and strange lunar anomalies, or even anomalies on moons outside of ours, Phobos, for example. I think what we're looking at is sort of like a ancient civilization and a remnant technology. And I think maybe that might have even been ours if we were a spacefaring galactic sort of species before, and there was some kind of cataclysm. Then everything got reset in the solar system, and we started from scratch. And here we are again, kind of like going out into space and seeing some of this stuff. And some of it might be just like autonomous drones, like technology that was so well built. Maybe it's not ours. Maybe it is like a an intergalactic spacefaring species that has this technology that's able to come into our solar system and go out. I think that's what we're looking at. I think that's what we're seeing. And I think we've been to the moon. I'm not, there's so many different interesting theories out there. There's people that believe that the Earth is flat and that we're just like in a giant stage surrounded by a glass bubble, and everything is projected to us, and nothing is real about the reality that we live in. And I don't really prescribe to that theory. I think that science has taken us so far that it proves that we're living on a sphere and we're surrounded by other sphere astral bodies and stuff. But these are just different theories that are out there. And if somebody can 100% prove to me that, we didn't go to the moon. Another part of that is that Russia early on knew that they weren't going to make it to the moon. They didn't have the funding. The USSR was always on the brink of collapse leading up to the 1990s, right? And their way of attacking us on that front is to spread propaganda, is to publish papers and say, oh, the math proves that there's no way they could have taken a rocket into orbit with the payload that NASA said that they had and made it all the way to the moon and back. They just didn't even have the technology to do it. Like, that was their big propaganda, sort of disinformation campaign of the 1960s and 70s. And that's just because, they got sour grapes. They're sad that they can't do the same thing. I think the United States is a technical leader in the world when it comes to aerospace technology, and the NASA space program proved that. And I think we have been to the moon, and there's pretty bad, silly arguments that we haven't been.
Now, how far do you think that our modern secret space program is able to go right now? We have plenty of people who come out and are claiming that they're in these black project secret space programs where they're actually traveling to Mars and they're fighting aliens and they're on bases on moons and they're doing this through like some sort of weird consciousness transfer and 20 and back program. There's no way for us to discount it or know for sure if they're telling the truth, but some of these seem a bit too extreme for me, and I want to get your thoughts on how far you think our actual secret space program has gone.
I would love to talk to Corey Good, David Wilcock. I've already talked to Anthony Rodriguez. I'm open to this, you know, like the world is an interesting place and perhaps the universe has answers we in the public are just not exposed to. So, you know, if Corey Good, David Wilcock, any of these secret space guys are listening, I'm more than happy to discuss and figure out what's happening in terms of a secret space program. But right now, I'm convinced that we had technology probably pacing our liquid rocket technology, but it was clandestine research that was happening through the Air Force and the Navy, testing out things like the ARV at the same time, you know, and maybe some of those photos we have in space from the Gemini missions and Apollo, you know, who knows? Maybe some of those photos are our own UFOs that just were not public.
That's what another thing I was going to ask you is, what is it possible that some of this could have been our own black technology that we had possibly acquired through maybe some kind of UFO crash after Roswell? We know that the sightings increased after World War II, so could we have acquired some type of technology and been able to reverse engineer it, and that is what we were seeing out there?
Very possibly. I think that these are definitely logical assumptions that people can make, that, you know, if you believe that there's these UFO crash retrievals that were happening from the 1940s on, it's very possible that some of these were not from here and we're trying to reverse engineer this technology. And through reverse engineering in our crude way, we get things like the ARV and the TR-3B and other incarnations of these like anti-gravitic technologies that are being tested in airspace and possibly in outer space, in cislunar space, possibly going to the moon, possibly going beyond the moon. Who knows? I think it's very possible, especially when the military in the United States and other competing nations have a military budget of trillions every year. You know, we're not talking about just one year. Hey, we're going to get $600 billion to spend on this. You get some, you get some, you get some, you get some. You guys working on the ARV, we're going to say that's like loaves of bread that you bought, whatever. They have weird accounting practices that can be conducted in the military that elsewhere in the public, citizens like you and I, if we were reporting our taxes, we would be thrown into jail for life if we tried to pull off these same accounting practices. So I think it's very possible that money could have been used on black projects to test out UFO type technology throughout the ages in our space age exploits. And, you know, you even see video clips and images of weird UFO encounters or weird UFO instances that have happened during the STS missions or the ISS experiments. And that's all super modern video. And what do you see? You see like triangular shaped craft. You see the classic disc shaped craft still. So is that ours or is that theirs? That's the sort of question we have. That's the argument that's out there. And or is it all just CGI and swamp gas? Yeah. I don't know if there's swamp gas in space, but I'm sure there's some debunkers out there.
Now, I want to go back to your documentary, and you touch on the possibilities of what our presidents actually know, and that UFOs are probably most likely on our need-to-know basis. But you also posed the question if some of our more modern presidents may have been briefed on some aspects of UFOs. When we go back to Eisenhower, it's very interesting some of the things that happened, some of the possibilities that have come out that he possibly met with ETs. He seemingly was trying to warn us about the dangers of the military-industrial complex as well. So what do you think about the need-to-know basis with presidencies and how much they knew?
I think, now that UFOs have been a topic for more than 70 years in the general public, modern presidents like George Bush, Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, Donald Trump, they're all keen to find out if there's something there. I think when they get requests, when they give those requests, they probably get the same sort of answer, which is like, this is on a need to know. But there's reports that Trump was briefed. There's reports that that Barack Obama was briefed. And I think when you hear about these reports of these presidents being briefed, you have to remember that being briefed means many different things. Sometimes it doesn't mean that they're being briefed by high-ranking military officials. Sometimes it does. And in the case of Trump, I think he was briefed by high-ranking military officials. And that's what led to him eventually requesting that all intelligence agencies release their papers, you know, with that executive order that got signed into effect at the end of 2020. And in the beginning of 2021, in January, we started to see that action coming about. And the CIA was the first agency to release a big declassification of documents. And it's through that document dump that we were able to, in the documentary, show some more modern files that can prove that NASA was kind of covering up the X-15 mission UFO encounters. So there was a bunch of guys like Mr. Deal, Robert Greenwood, all these, like, at the time, well-known sort of UFO researchers that were requesting the footage and still images from the X-15 missions where these pilots had reported seeing UFOs. And NASA's answer and the military organization's answer, once it started going up the ladder in terms of request, was no, you don't have the need to know. We literally have that written on the paper that came out of the CIA dump from 2021. So, you know, the CIA has access to this history of UFO encounters that dates back to, you know, the 1940s and maybe beyond. I don't know. What are the other agencies sitting on? And what is NASA sitting on? Because NASA is a research agency that is it's kind of like the nerd instrument of the military and intelligence defense agencies of the United States. So they must have tons of stuff regarding UFOs, which makes you wonder, what's this whole UAP research group that they are setting up now? What's that about, if not to just be some kind of official front to say there's nothing here, or this is what we know, these are the possibilities from a scientific and academic standpoint, let's not get too woo about this, everybody, right? Mm-hmm. That might be what the real intention is. To me, if they've had information that they've been sitting on that's been classified since X-15 missions, it's just a PR exercise.
Well, they're definitely seeming to, especially in the past few years, especially since 2017 with the New York Times article, they're painting aspects of this as a threat and a threat to national security. And there's been plenty of interesting things that have happened since then, especially even since 2020. One of the most interesting is the Israeli former space defense guy coming out and saying that there's a galactic federation.
Yeah, Arshad.
And, yeah, and all these things. But in reality, we don't have anything that can actually connect what we understand as extraterrestrials to these UFOs. Like we were talking about earlier, it's possible that it could all be our black technology, but there is a lot of muddying of waters when it comes to extraterrestrials. There's intentional insertion of people from intelligence agencies, counterintelligence, to spread different types of information about what we understand as extraterrestrials and the UFO phenomenon, and this has been going on for years. So it just makes me wonder how much we can trust coming out of our government to be true.
Yeah, that is good deductive reasoning. And like, I'm trying to find this email because I actually had a back and forth email with Arshad, the former director of the Space Agency for Israel. Mm. And I was basically asking him, like, when you say that NASA and the United States know that there's extraterrestrial intelligence out there and they're interacting with Earth they're interacting with human beings. You know, 'cause he said in that statement, and it didn't come, it went through a, like, I think originally in a Israeli newspaper. I need to look that up, but basically it said like Galactic Federation, and we've heard Galactic Federation before. Mm. Especially in the UFO community, there's, you know, apparently Ashtar Space Command and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
But how real is that, right? So I asked Arshad, you know, when you said that there's this Galactic Federation, were you saying this based on your opinion, because of something that you had read or you had deduced from your own reasoning, or do you have proof from experience that there's a Galactic Federation? He said, I'm sorry, I'm not speaking any further on this subject. Mm. And I was speaking to him in Hebrew because Hebrew, I think. I was using Google Translate, and his answer both times was like, I'm sorry, I'm not speaking to this subject in the public at this point. So that meant to me that he could have said in the email, my statement was misinterpreted, that was a mistake I made, or this is a fabrication somebody published in their whatever. He didn't say that. He just said, I'm not speaking to this. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. I don't know. Maybe there's something there. Maybe there's some truth to us being in contact, you know, the military and space agencies. And there's many different space agencies. There's a European Space Agency, Canadian Space Agency. There's, you know, space agencies in places like Saudi Arabia and Turkey. And so the Chinese have their own space agency, and they've been to the moon with
their
own vehicles.
Well, I find very interesting is private aerospace companies are doing experiments and research on places like Skinwalker Ranch, places that have a lot of UFO sightings, but not only that, other high strangeness. But they're not only looking in the skies, they're looking underground, they're looking for magnetic anomalies. So it makes me think that there's a lot of high strange connections to this UFO phenomenon that these either aerospace companies, black projects, military know a lot more than they're ever letting on about.
Oh yeah, 100%. I'd say there has to be a mainstream science acceptable theory, and then there has to be an outlier science research program that's happening all around the world that the public is not supposed to know about. And that would include researching UFOs, testing new technologies that are not fossil fuel based in terms of energy, possibly testing new propulsion methods, like even nuclear propulsion methods. We know that there was the Dyson rocket in the 1950s, and that was a nuclear powered rocket. Like, and just the existence of that is in a international standard. If that were powerful enough to go to space, that's illegal, that craft, that vehicle, because you're not supposed to have anything nuclear capable in space. Due to the fact that it kind of like it blurs the lines between something being weaponizable in space as well as could become a dirty bomb. What if that nuclear powered satellite or rocket comes back into the atmosphere and goes and lands in the middle of a city? Well, you have a nuclear disaster right there, right? So we know that there's certain technologies that were tested in North American history. Are other nations doing that same thing? I think yes.
I'm pretty sure that they had the technology in existence on these higher levels of military and black projects could be 50 to 100 years ahead of anything that we had could ever imagine, and the free energy implications there alone just would is probably why that we're never going to find out about a lot of this stuff because we wouldn't have to rely on the government or anything else for our energy purposes anymore.
100%. I mean, we have that sentiment echoed through Jim Goodall, who is best friends with Ben Rich, the former president of Skunk Works, which is the Lockheed Martin, test program for prototype craft and black budget sort of projects. Ben Rich said to him on his deathbed, apparently, we have the technology to take ET home, and anything that you know of, that your creative mind knows of, we have 100 years ahead of that in terms of propulsion, whatever, right? So does that mean that they have, when he says we have that, does that mean that we built it ourselves, or have we captured downed craft and been testing that craft with our own pilots? That's the question. And did that downed craft come from not an Earth source? That's another question too.
What do you see happening in the next maybe 5 to 10 years with disclosure? Are you encouraged that it will keep developing and going forward and we'll keep discovering new things and maybe hearing things from our government? Or do you think it's going to be just like it always has been? We'll have a little trickle of information here, and then maybe 5, 10 years, we'll get another little trickle of information and it'll go 5 steps back. But I don't know. What do you think?
I think we're leading up to like more disclosure in the public, dissemination of more information that we might not be alone and that some of these anomalies are not accounted for by an enemy nation or our own inventory. And I think part of that is because we're going to be expanding out into space publicly more than we have any time before. I mean, you have so many private space industries taking off right now, like SpaceX, Blue Origin, Virgin Galactic, you know, and the list just keeps going on. You've got essentially NASA starting up Artemis and trying to officially take us to Mars. Like, it's going to be happening in a bigger way in space in terms of our exploration publicly again. And if we're going to run into more anomalies like that, and it's going to be a lot harder with this age of information that we live in, with cameras everywhere and, you know, the internet linking everybody instantaneously to artificially intelligent, you know, advanced search methods and advanced educational methods. Like, you can't really keep the cat in the bag any longer. And I think that the military and the intelligence agencies and the defense agencies know that. And I think they know that they got to let the cat out of the bag as we progress technologically here on the planet and into space, so that we're not caught off guard by some of this stuff, and that also they can have their own means and motives met in a public space. So if they want to arm space technologically with more advanced military equipment, and they want to assist space travel to Mars, for example, with a military apparatus, you know, a space force to assist our landing and colonizing of another planet within our solar system, they kind of, it's in their best interest to have the public know about possible dangers that they didn't know about before. And I think that's how disclosure will be used. It would be more of like a military disclosure process to advance their own means and their own interests in space and on the planet.
Yeah, it would make sense if they're indeed out there and sectors of our government know about it already, and we're going to eventually all be headed out there. Why not, you know, let the cat out of the bag and trickle that information out so that by the time we're out there, we have a little bit of an understanding of what could possibly be there, right?
100%. Yeah.
Yeah, man.
I mean, we didn't go to the moon with no military involvement, right? Like, NASA is in bed with the military. There's military encrypted channels with all of our space missions. The military is part of all of that action. So if we're going to be in the public settling onto another planet, the military has to have a presence. There has to be a public agenda playing out there to secure those missions. And I think UAPs and UFOs are going to be part of that negotiation with the public.
Yeah. We live in very fascinating times. I'm super excited to see where all this is going in our future. Darcy, great documentaries. I highly recommend everyone go check it out. Let everyone know where they can find Secret Space UFOs, NASA's first missions, and your website and all your good stuff.
Cool. So that film is completely free. If people want to go to a streaming site called TubiTV.com, they can watch it for free there in Australia, the United States, and I think Mexico and Canada as well. So that probably accounts for a big portion of your audience. It's also available in the UK and parts of Europe via iTunes, Amazon, and Google Play and stuff like that. So, you know, I appreciate people checking it out, reaching out to me on social media, on Instagram. I go by Darcy Weir Films, Facebook, Darcy Weir, TikTok, Darcy Weir Films, Occult Journeys on TikTok, and my website is occultjourneys.com, and on YouTube I also go by Cult Journeys. That's the name of my documentary studio. And yeah, I appreciate the time, Chris. It's always great talking with you, man.
Yes, sir. Always a good time. And we'll have to do it again soon. And until next time, everyone have an excellent evening. I'm going on vacation. I will be back next week. And we will see y'all then.